It's very cool and it's really exciting. But again, it's something that it took us till 2021 to get to that stage of being able to do that.
Hello and welcome to the How the Fuck podcast. You just heard the voice of Jennifer Montague, Director of Marketing at Dixa. Dixa's been going from strength to strength recently. They've raised 105 million Series C funding in June this year and have doubled in size since Jen joined in late 2019. Since then, Jen and her team have been busy completing a rebrand, acquisition announcements, two funding announcements, and they've set up the process that we're going to deep dive into today, which is all about how your marketing team can generate a ton of high intent inbound leads and nurture them through to sales handoff without pissing off your sales team. If you're looking for good arguments on the gated versus ungated lead gen debate, ideas for creating content that generates leads even if you're a small company, and best practice on lead nurture and sales handoffs, then this is the episode for you. Hope you enjoy it, and when you're done, don't forget to follow Jen on LinkedIn. She's always posting great video content from her own podcast, Marketing Corner, which I think you guys are going
to
love.
Hi, Jen. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. So why don't we start off with just like a bit about your background and like just get to know who you are a little bit and your journey in marketing so far.
Yeah, brilliant. So my name is Jen Montague. I'm originally from New York. I lived in England for a long time and then Switzerland. Oh. I became a British citizen 10 years ago. So took my oath to Queen and Country. So I'm here as a Brit, yes.
Whereabouts?
I studied in the north in Lancaster and I did my postgraduate up there and then worked in Kingston and then ended in Brighton. So my last sort of 6-7 years in England were in Brighton on the sea. So love Brighton. And then after that I moved to Switzerland, and that's kind of where I started really getting into marketing. I actually worked at FIFA in Zurich, Switzerland, and at the time I was doing the transfer of football players, right? So when you have the transfer window, you have to get your football players transferred within a certain time frame, and I found that the more I invested in communication channels such as Twitter, newsletters and things like that, the less basic questions I would get from my clients. And so we could process their transfers quicker and smoother, enabled me as a client services representative to focus on those really important cases. And so I kind of said to my manager, hey, I'd really like to do marketing. I kind of like this marketing thing. But FIFA being FIFA, it's a very corporate structure. They kind of said, that's cool, but we have a marketing team. So thanks anyway. And then I had the opportunity to relocate to Denmark in 2016. So when I relocated, that's actually where I decided I really want to get kind of go all in marketing. And so I took on an internship actually at a startup, a PPC intern, because I really wanted to learn the paid side of advertising, and loved it. I went to Google Bootcamp, Facebook Bootcamp, LinkedIn Bootcamp. I was always in Dublin where all the headquarters are, and I was just constantly learning. And within about a year, I was running the paid department, which was fantastic. And I got to try out a lot of really cool things. And then from there, my career has just kind of gone from strength to strength. So I'm really happy I took that. I don't want to call it a break in my career, but it went from kind of being on one trajectory to stopping and starting over again, which was kind of scary. But I wouldn't be here without it. So I'm really lucky.
Well, I find a lot of people do that way into marketing. Like they find out that they just really enjoy it suddenly and just fall into it.
I think a lot of people kind of do a little bit of marketing without realizing they're doing it, or they think they're doing marketing and they're missing out huge chunks of it. You know, so I was very good at writing. I was writing all the newsletters for FIFA, and that is marketing in a sense. But I really wanted to learn about the algorithms and, you know, how ads work and how you optimize ads and the kind of nuts and bolts of it. And that's where I needed an internship, because that's kind of hard to find on your own.
I think that's actually a good way to start learning marketing in advertising, because you just get into like the psychology of how it all works, and also the social platforms and why people are there and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
So now you're at Dixa. How's that been?
Oh, it's a rocket ship. It's been phenomenal and very fast growing. So when I arrived, I think we doubled in size since I've arrived, and I arrived at the end of 2019. So it's been, a very quick trajectory, but I've had so many career firsts at Dixa in such a short time. I've been there just under 2 years and I've already done a rebrand. I've done an acquisition announcement. I've done two funding announcements. So yeah, it's a lot happening in a very short amount of time, which is great for my kind of need to be constantly active.
Yeah. What does your sort of day-to-day look like at the moment at Dixa? Like, not at the moment. Sorry.
At the moment, not much, being on maternity leave, but
yeah.
Sleep, eat. Prior to that, yes, my day usually consisted of, checking how we are doing in terms of lead gen. So we have certain targets that we have to meet. I was in charge of, as the director, I oversaw all marketing initiatives. But at the same time, I was also largely responsible for the lead generation side of the business. So I would check how we're doing against targets, check how we're doing on spend. If we're on par for spend, I would speak to sales. How are the leads doing? How are the quality of leads coming through? And then I would speak to my branding team because they would always have lots on their plate, whether it's a customer case story, updating the website, coming up with white papers and things like that. So kind of overseeing everyone's tasks, but at the same time having an execution side where I was executing upon all the PPC ads and paid social ads.
Interesting. Cool. And Dixa sounds like a very cool company too. I had a lot of time to compare all the different like big players in the market, and I'm loving Dixa the most.
It's very cool. And I think I like to say it's like a grown-up startup. I mean, now we're kind of scale up, but I've worked in startups before, but Dixa was the first place that it feels there is a touch of this corporate structure in a good way, you know, in this kind of organized manner. There's a clear vision, we're going for this vision. And I've worked in some places where it's kind of, the vision can maybe change and the goalposts move as people's opinions change, but Dixa has always been, this is where we want to be. And that's been really fun to see it happen.
I think having that vision is one super important thing. And then there's like, and I think I heard the founder on the podcast that I listened to just before this was talking about how we have like a very clear go-to-market strategy that works now. And mm-hmm. it's sort of scalable. Like, I'm very much looking forward to us having that where we know, okay, this works. We just need to execute really well.
Yeah. But that's a really important step, right? It doesn't happen overnight. I've never been in a place that it just happens overnight. And there was maybe some chaos. There always is where you figure this out and you're exactly like you said, you know, you're learning what works, you're learning what resonates. Maybe originally the people you want to go after isn't the target market that actually sticks with you. And, you know, you're constantly learning, but once you hit that sweet spot, it's just strength upon strength, that's the kind of place we're at now, which is really exciting.
That's really cool. It's fun. It is definitely fun. It's a fun stage. So do you run like, what would be a typical, like, marketing generates leads and passes them to sales and sales follows up on those leads? And like, is it that kind of workflow process?
We actually have, I guess you could describe it as kind of two tracks simultaneously, because we have a very good lead intelligence team. And so what our lead intelligence team do is they first and foremost kind of source leads. So they know who our core ICP is, our core ideal customer profile. They know what a good fit is. And so they're already going out finding these companies or even the buyer persona and feeding them into sales. But at the same time, we also run an inbound happening at the same time. So there's kind of the sales outreach side and and an inbound side happening simultaneously. So sales are going after the contacts and the leads that are sourced. But then at the same time, we are running inbound where the leads are coming to us. And then our lead intelligence team are looking at them saying, would this be a good fit? Would it not? And then figuring out what goes forward as a sales accepted lead.
Okay. So does that lead intelligence team, are they finding like contact information, or are they actually getting downloads on books and eBooks?
They're actually looking for people. So they know what companies we want and they're actively looking for that. Whereas the emails and stuff is coming through inbound. So that's where we put our content out. We put out content that we know our core market would like. If they download it, then that's kind of the inbound track. But then the lead intelligence team will see that and say, is this a good lead, or is this a student doing a research paper or something like that? You know, is it a legitimate someone that we would like sales to reach out to? So they're kind of have their, you know, they're planted in both sides of the outreach and the inbound efforts.
That's cool. Yeah, I went and downloaded a webinar earlier today.
Okay, so you'll be getting some stuff from us shortly.
That's right. I wanted to watch it, but I was also both kind of interested in how the follow-up would look like. But yeah, you have like, I don't know, do you use what happens on your webinar is you watch the first minute and then it says fill out this contact form to watch the rest. Which is actually kind of genius. I imagine a little bit annoying for some people, but also, you know, that's the way it is.
Yes.
Do you use a tool to do that, like a software, or have you built that kind of system?
We use Livestorm.
Okay.
Where that is part of it. And Wistia.
That's a good tool.
It's great. I love Wistia. I absolutely adore Wistia. So, but we use Livestorm for the webinars. And then I believe once we do the hosting, we can put those cards up. And actually what we did was we A/B tested that as well. So we've tested it in the very beginning before it starts. We tested it in the middle, and then we tested it near the end, and then not having it at all. And even though, yes, it is annoying, the people who are willing to fill that out are willing to usually go through a sales process, right? So they're more serious, and that is, sales are tend to have a better conversation with those people than people who either don't give their information or wait until the last minute kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's cool. I think it's an interesting one. I think it does come into that debate about like do you get people, do you gate content, or do you just educate and let everyone go for free? And I was going to say, where do you fall on that kind of argument of gated, ungated MQLs versus just go for the demo request? Yeah, what do you think?
I don't know the answer. I know what I've tried, and I know what tends to work better, because actually one of the things that we found when I used to work at Planday, which is also a SaaS B2B startup in Copenhagen, and we actually tested this out extensively, was when we make it free, let me start again by saying it depends on the nature of the content, right? So if it is a top 10 list, a checklist, or, you know, things like that, let everyone have access to it. You know, it's important to educate people, because we also know that there are people out there who are interested in customer support who won't be a customer. But we want to share, we want to kind of show our idea of customer support. You know, we don't believe in tickets, we believe in conversations. And so we do have this movement that we're a part of, and we don't want to gate that movement. But then as that content goes a little bit further down the funnel and it gets a bit more specific to our product, that's when we'll start to gate it. Because then if you're looking for features, if you're looking for more specific about Dixa, then we'd love to talk to you about what we can do. So it kind of depends on the nature of the content and where that person is in the buyer journey, that we gate it or not.
Okay. Have you tested, I guess, I can imagine that if say like 100 people come to read this more middle of funnel, bottom of funnel kind of ebook, do you think having say like 50 of them just go, oh no, I don't want to give my contact information, versus, and then those 50 that do, probably more ready to actually talk to sales, versus just 100 people reading it. I wonder if you could test those two things and see who came in inbound or who went to revenue at the end of the day, what would work?
That's something that we actually do try to do. So what we have the ability to do, right, is if we do, we have A/B tested gated and not gated. And the difficult part of not gated is, of course, we use retargeting and we try to re-engage you that way. Tends to be a bit more expensive. But again, like I said, if people aren't willing to give us their email address, chances are maybe they're not ready, right? They're not ready to talk to sales. And when if we were to pass that on to sales, sales will have a hard time with that person, or, you know, it takes up sales' time. So what we try to do, yeah, we have A/B tested it in the past, and it tends to be, well, we put in different workflows as well. So for example, if you're one of the A/B testers who didn't give us your email address, but you got the access to the content, we can still retarget you and try to re-engage with you in another way, versus those who do give us their email address. Those people tend to go further along in the process, and obviously much faster. So it depends on, in my experience, it depends on what it is you're trying to accomplish. And again, like I said earlier, it's kind of the nature of the content. If it's changing people's minds, if it's, you know, trying to change the way people see customer support, then hopefully if we're successful in that, they will want to learn more. They will want to, you know, come on this journey with us. And that's the plan.
Okay. Interesting. That's cool. It's nice to have someone who's, I guess, actually tested it and just thought it through, really. It's cool. Definitely need to think about it a lot more. And we haven't been A/B testing, but we've been trying it out, like the whole top of funnel content, and then having we have a group of say like a few hundred target customers, and we try to get as many as them to read it and then retarget them with the ads and things. That's still underway, but trying to see that without any kind of email. But one of the problems is we don't know who is there, who is reading it, or yeah, like when you get their email, at least you're like, okay, cool, like that company, we should try to talk to them more. And But yeah, you have to sort of trust that these people will come inbound someday.
And you have to also be careful with the new tracking changes where, you know, retargeting people, I think, is going to get harder and harder to do, especially if they come from a third party. Whereas if you have their email address, their first party data, right? So you're allowed to communicate with them. But yeah, it's definitely a balancing act. And one of the things that I've found really successful, even though it makes things a little bit longer, is to have this ungated content, right? And then retarget them with gated content that is relevant and kind of related to what they engaged with. Yeah. So say you do a blog post about 10 signs it's time to switch to conversations for customer support, for example, and people read that, then maybe the next thing you'll send them is benefits of having conversations, but then that could be an ebook. And then, you know, so it's kind of related, but now it's like, okay, here's the second piece of content that is related, but kind of one step further. What is a benefit, right? And you're talking the benefits. And then once you have their email address, it's like, oh, here's a webinar. Here's, you know, and we use HubSpot. Mm-hmm. So we only need to collect that email address one time. And then, so we don't have to ask for it over and over and over again, which is pretty annoying for people as well. So, you know, you kind of get it that one time. They can opt out if they want. And, you know, so you're kind of, the important thing is to provide value. Mm-hmm. We're not kissing on the first date, right? We're not, you know, sign up for a demo. We've just met. It's, you know, oh, you found this interesting. Then you're going to find this interesting. Then you're going to find this interesting. Mm-hmm. And hey, now that you're here, and we use a lead scoring model as well. So the more pieces of content they engage with, the more points they get. So by you visiting that webinar, you probably just got 50 points, which means that you would be more engaged than maybe someone who just read a blog post. And so that's how we kind of gauge how educated someone is in what we do, which makes sales life easier when they are kind of handed over to sales.
The sort of lead intelligence team participate in that, like understanding when someone is scored high enough and passing them over, or is that?
Yeah, so once they hit a threshold of points, then lead intelligence look at them. So if you're checking out one webinar, maybe a blog post, and then you lose interest, we're not going to bother you, or, you know, we're not going to engage with you. But if you're two webinars in, a bunch of blog posts, an e-paper, then once you hit, you know, say 100 points, then lead intelligence are notified and they're like, hey, okay, let's look at this Ben guy. Let's see, where does he work and what's that company like? Would this company be an interesting fit? And then if the answer is yes, then it's, hey, sales, you might want to reach out to him and just say, hey, Ben, we see that you've engaged with some of our content. Would you be up for a call? Would you love a demo? We'd love to see how we can help you. So that's how we avoid engaging with people who maybe aren't ready yet, and go and help sales enable sales to kind of make the most of their time on the people who look like they could be ready for a demo or something of that nature.
I think it makes a lot of sense. And when I look at what maybe like the back end systems and stuff, or like the way it works for us, I think the volume would be sort of too low to make it, like we'd have to, I guess the ad spend can't be too high at the moment because we're not really well funded. So it would be hard to like set up all of this sort of lead scoring. I think at your stage of company, that makes like total sense, but we need to get to that point where that becomes the system we need to set up. I don't know. What do you think?
It's an excellent point. And it's a luxury of larger teams. You know, Dick, so we're nearly 200 people now. We have a marketing team of about a dozen people. So it's definitely a luxury we have. It's the same with the attribution models and things that we have, is something that a company our size, who are doing so many different things across so many different channels, we need a way of keeping track of where that money's going and where it's working. But for smaller teams, it's definitely, and this is actually something we talk a lot about on the podcast I have with Casper Rockman, the Marketing Corner podcast. We try to focus on smaller companies, one person armies. You know, how can you make an impact with maybe limited resources and things like that? And I always find that in those cases, when you have a smaller team, maybe you don't have a ton of channels operating at the same time. So it's a bit easier to keep an eye on the different channels you have open. So maybe you're just doing paid social and low intent channels like Google or Bing, and you can kind of keep an eye on what's working. Whereas we have ABM tools, we have review sites, we have PR, we have SEO agencies, we have everything. So I don't think that that's something that a smaller team needs to do just yet. But I think to know, it's a chicken and egg, isn't it? Because in order to grow, you do need to nurture these leads, right? It's tough to, in our industry, especially B2B, you have to earn trust. You have to prove yourself. You have to make sure that when you're going up against a Zendesk and, you know, household names, you're having to prove yourself big time. And how do you do that? You do that with content. You do that with branding and kind of getting your story out there, and you're getting customer testimonials out there. And that's very content heavy to get people to trust you. And then you can start to engage with them a little bit more.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the issue with a small company. Like, you, it's hard to get a big customer when they look at you and they think, oh, how do I trust them when they're so small, or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We got really lucky that I think like our first customer was British Airways or something. I don't know how that was done before my time, but like the people who come inbound to us seem to be like really cool for some reason. And I don't know if it's, mm-hmm. I think our products are kind of new, a little bit more like innovative, like AI. If it's just those particular teams for some reason are looking into it.
But I think that's a really good advantage though. And this is something we've seen at Dixa in a similar, you know, sense, is that you have the dinosaurs, right? You have the clunky, this is how it's always been done. And then you have the cool kids coming in going, why? Why do you have to do it that way? And, you know, for us at Dixa, you know, we built a system that works on how people talk to each other rather than, oh, your ticket number 632. And, you know, we will let you know when your ticket has been resolved. Like, and I think that's the cool thing that smaller companies like us, when you go up against behemoths, is we can move a lot faster and we can evolve a lot faster. You know, and I worked for one company where we talked about a speedboat versus a yacht. Like, mm-hmm. cool, you're big and you're stable, but you don't move with the times like we do, you know? So we're able to react super fast. We're able to react to GDPR changes a lot faster than maybe some of these other slower moving companies and things like that. And so it is an advantage. And I think when you, you know, one of our core ICPs are people who are tech savvy. We want people who understand digital. We want people who want to be digital. And we kind of focus on tech savvy companies as opposed to brick and mortar, because they tend to be able to move quickly with us and they like that about us. So it can be a really good advantage. Yeah.
Yeah. I really like that about like people going really specific into their ICPs on, like, I talked to someone the other day and she was telling me about her ICPs were like, we want this very specific person who is like the innovator and he loves technology and he's the buyer. And we tried to find that person very specifically.
Yep. And that's great. And some companies have those people and some do not, yeah. You know, or the person in the older company who is that person is tearing their hair out. That was me at FIFA. You know, that was me at FIFA when I was like, we need to do more on Twitter. We need to be more digital. And they're like, but if we put things on Twitter, people can be mean to us. It's like, you're FIFA. Of course people are going to be mean to you. But like, you know, that's not a reason to hide, you know? So I was the one who was like really pushing for that. And I think that's where I kind of found my niche in startups, where it's like, great idea. Go for it. Yeah. Build it, you know?
But we're learning every day, like what to be like, no, just ignore that company. Or actually, I won't go really specific, but there's a country that we know if we ever talk to that people from that country, they string it out for 2 years, the sales cycle and things. It's like, forget it. We don't have the time.
Yeah. I know a couple of countries like that as well. One of our core, you know, we stick in Scandinavia a lot, obviously being Scandinavian, but, you know, Nordic brands tend to be very hip and modern. And yes, I used the word hip just now, but... you know, that they roll with the punches, they have an international mindset, they all speak English, which makes our life a lot easier when it comes to localization. And then there's other countries where they're a bit more old school and things move a lot slower. There's a lot more checks, there's a lot more buy-in required and butt kissing in a way that maybe the Nordic people don't really buy into. So
yeah, I think that's it's an interesting one to like fit that to. I guess for Dixa, you're coming up against, as you said, these big incumbents and things. Actually, it makes much more sense for you to run along the innovative line and find the innovative players, because they're going to convert, versus people stuck in their way will be like, okay, I want to go with the big player who I trust and I take no risk.
What's interesting about that, what we found going up against these bigger players, I'll try to avoid saying specific names, but the person that we find often gets our foot in the door is the end user, is the customer service agent, you know, because they're the ones who are kind of fed up with the status quo. They're the ones who are like, you know, it'd be easy if I could have everything on one screen. Is that too much to ask? You know, it'd be great if I could just see all this person's communication with us in one place, you know, and that's the person we go for. We're like, hey, guess what? We have something that can do that. And then there, and that's where, again, a lot of content comes into play, because we make content for that person and we call that our champion. That's the person who's going to go to their boss and go, this is what I need. This is going to make my life easier. But then their boss is probably looking at something else. Maybe they're looking at first response time. So then they want something else. And then they're going to go to their boss, and maybe their boss is worried about business continuity. Well, if we revamp our entire customer support system, how much is that going to screw up business? You know? And so we have to have content for that person. So we have kind of a matrix of content based on the buyer persona to try to help them with making that case to their boss, essentially.
Yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, that's genius. How would that literally work? I guess if you have an agent who's frustrated, would you literally be like reaching out to them and being like, are you annoyed? Here's this content.
I do that through paid social. Okay. So that would be my strategy through paid social, is to look for the buyer persona who is the customer service agent. And literally, like you said, call it out in the ad copy, calling all customer service agents. Are you sick and tired of this? Are you looking to do that? And then engage with them that way. So that would be like the, and that would be a piece of content, right? That, like I said earlier, that's the content on a blog post. Check this out. Here's ways that you can make your own life easier. You know, they're not ready for Dixie yet, but have you heard about this or have you thought about that? And then if they engage in that, then we would probably send them another ad where, like I said, it's gated content, a bit more specific. But the hard part is if they forward something to their boss, right? But if they download a white paper and they send it to their boss and they go, hey, check this out, this is really good, then hopefully we can engage with that boss somehow and send them something different and do it that way. But we start with ICP, as in the account, the kind of business we're after. And then we look at the buyer persona and different content for those different personas based on what we think they care about.
That's interesting. I think that what you touched on it very like briefly there about how you said you have the matrix where you have each sort of layer of really like the person at the top has the budget and what they care about also really matters. But how do you get from that agent and make sure that the other person doesn't just read what the agent, the other person reads the right content? Like, how do you?
Well, yeah, that's the difficult part. Because you can't really tell, right? The way tracking goes and things like that. If you're the customer service agent and you're the one engaging with us, we're going to give you what we understand customer service agents care about. But if they're the ones getting the demo, maybe what our sales team will say is, okay, great. Thank you for signing up for the demo. You'd be interested in seeing how this actually makes your life easier. But in our experience, it might be good to have your customer service manager on the call as well, just because they're going to have questions. Maybe if it's a bigger company, you know, have your CTO or whoever's in charge of integrations, because we have a lot of integrations, maybe have them on the call. And so we kind of advise them on who should be present so we can answer all the questions at once. And then we have documentation for them. So when that question comes up about business continuity, we say, well, we can have you onboarded in 24 hours. Here's how that works. When that question comes up about integrations, here's our website on integrations. Here's everyone we partner with. So we kind of have to have that conversation in the first instance to make sure we get it to the right people. But taking that aside, we also have an ABM platform that, again, a company of Dix's size has the luxury of getting. But this has also helped make our life easier, because we can look at your company and go, okay, this is the customer service person. This is the customer service manager. This is the CTO. This is the CEO. And we can target different content based on their vertical, which I think is really sexy. So we're like, hey, you're in the e-commerce business. We have a string of e-commerce documentation. And here's what the customer service person thinks about. Here's what the manager thinks about here. And so we can target them that way.
And so you target the ads within one company, different people.
Correct.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. Very cool.
It's very cool. And it's really exciting. But again, it's something that it took us till 2021 to get to that stage of being able to do that. So it's not something I think a smaller company will do overnight, but there's a lot of things that are possible once you kind of get to that stage.
What kind of content would you suggest like an earlier stage company do? Let's say like you're in the more early stages and you can't write 10 blogs for each stage, you know, or you don't have the resources and things. Like, what do you think would drive most impact?
You know, I get asked this a lot because we would talk to a lot of smaller teams. I would say to start, if you're like the one person army who is starting everything from scratch, right? I would maybe hire freelancers. You know, you have Fiverr, you have Upwork, you have these different places where you could get kind of upper level branding. Why are you doing this? Why did you make this product? What is good about it? And try to test the waters, see what people like. So I would start with upper funnel stuff. And some people don't agree. Some people prefer focusing heavily on lower funnel to get those, you know, because you do need leads, right? If you're going to build a business and you're going to get more people on your team, you're going to need to generate revenue. For me, it's like, why would anyone trust you if they never heard of you before? Why would they Google you if they never heard of you before? You know, so it's a very chicken and egg situation. But what I would usually do is start with basic content that you can do. And then what you can do is look into your Google Analytics and you can see what content are people clicking on? Where are they losing interest? Where do they stop reading? One of the companies I worked at, for example, I think we had about 400 blog posts and we were writing a new blog post every week and we were hiring freelancers and everyone's, you know, being kept very busy. But when I looked in the Google Analytics, I saw that one blog post from like 2 years earlier had 85% of our clicks. So instead of writing all these new posts, we took that blog post and we chopped it up, right? We made it into a webinar. We made it into an infographic. You know, you take the thing that's working and just chop it up and kind of milk it, right? You milk it as much as you can because you know that that's working. And that's kind of how you gauge, for me, what content people want to read and what people want to learn about you.
Interesting.
And then from there, that can also help tailor your ads, right? Because if you know the headline that made them click, well, guess what? That will probably work in an ad as well to something else. And so kind of build it from that perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to get some efficiency and just learn from what you do have when you don't have lots to go from. Cool. I think I've asked you all the questions that I wanted to ask you. Do you still run experiments at Dixer?
Yes, like, always.
Looking for new application channels and things like that, or
new channels, new creatives, new headlines, new platforms, new landing pages. We are always testing. And I would say anyone just constantly test, but don't test too many things at once, because then you go bananas with all the granular information. But yeah, any ad I do, I'm doing two different versions of, whether I'm doing a blue background and a green background, or a human being and a product, or even if it's two human beings, different genders or different ethnicities, like there's always things you can learn. And I'll give you an example actually of one thing that we did at my previous company. We did exactly this. So same audience, same headline, same budget, same ad copy, everything's exactly the same. But first we had the product and then we had a human being. And then we saw the human being had the most conversions. Okay, so we're going to try two human beings. We're going to try a man and a woman. Then we saw the man had more clicks, which went against a lot of what people thought. They thought, oh, the pretty girl. The pretty girl will get clicked on the most. But that, you know, that's why you test stuff. The pretty girl didn't get clicked on the most. Then we were like, okay, so it's a man. And then we were trying different ethnicities. And the man, I would say, is ethnically ambiguous, is what I would say. You couldn't tell their ethnicity. That person got the most clicks by far. And so that's the spokesperson essentially that we use, because there's something about him that people were like, I want to learn more. And so it's not science in any way. It's just, you know, what resonates. It was the same ad copy, same budget, same people. And then that's how we kind of just tweaked and tweaked and tweaked and tweaked. And then we would try, do you want to save time or money? And then we found out, actually, when I asked sales, you know, first I go to sales and I say, what do you think people care about? What's going to resonate with people? And of course, sales say money, because when you're talking to a salesperson, you're there to get the best deal, right? You're talking to a salesperson, you're wheeling and dealing, but actually, what do people care about when you're not asking them? And so I did, again, same creative, same headline, same budget, same audience, save time, save money. 100% of our conversions came through save time. So that, again, went against the hypothesis of the group. But then we saw an uptick in leads because we were saying save time with this. And then when sales had that first call, I hear you're looking to save time. And that really helped get that conversation going, you know, I think testing is super, super important to figure out what resonates best and what people want to engage with.
How much, this is like a PPC question, I guess. Like, how much money would you, or how many clicks gives you like an experiment that you say, I'm confident in one or the other?
That's a very good question. How long is a piece of string? No, I think it is hard. If you only have, I was trying stuff where I had like, when we did, for example, lead gen ads, and that's where the person fills out the form in Facebook or Instagram or LinkedIn, we'd get 12, right? And if you get 8 and 4. Yeah. So, but when I looked at clicks, you know, sometimes you have to just make a call. So, if you can't do it based on leads, look at clicks, or look at, you know, Facebook, for example, will show one particular ad more than the other because it gets more attention. So you can kind of see impressions. So there are other metrics you can kind of look at to give you a better idea of what to do. That might not be a definitive lead, if that makes sense. So, you know, if you can't look at leads, look at traffic. If you can't look at traffic, look at clicks. If you can't look at clicks, look at impressions, and just maybe keep pulling focus out to give yourself a starting line of where to go and try it from there. I try to save about 10% of my budget for tests. You know, so you always have, you know, what's working, but then throw in a wild card and see what happens. And that's kind of where a lot of our ad creatives evolved, because we would do, you know, stuff that was aligned with our website, and then we'd throw in a wild card and see if that worked. And sometimes it did. And you're like, ah, okay, well, I guess we're doing that now, you know, and 10% of a budget isn't really, hopefully not going to break the bank, as long as you learn from it, right? As long as you get some kind of learning, then it's money well spent, in my opinion.
Lots of things to experiment with there.
Yeah, it's a little overwhelming. It can be, so.
Yeah.
It's always, one thing at a time.
It's always a case of like just resources. Like I'd love to continuously experiment with different stuff, but you can't do so. You're going to do so many at once. So then how do you prioritize the experiment you do?
And there's also one of the things that I find even now is this kind of marketing by consensus is something that I think a lot of marketers face, where it's like someone else comes in and goes, I don't like that. And you're like, but the data shows this is what works. Yeah, but I don't like it. So change it. Or, you know, a lot of times, and this is not strictly a Dixa thing, but anytime I've ever worked anywhere, you know, you launch a campaign and 2 days later, it's not working, turn it off. Or it's not working, change it. And it's like, no, you got to let it run. You know, marketing is not a overnight, especially B2B like us. It's not an overnight win. It's iterative and it's prolonged. And you know, at the end of the month, we'll look and we'll see what worked and what didn't, and then we'll change it. But there is a lot of pressure, I think, to when someone says jump, you say how high, and you have to have the confidence to say, no,
wait,
this is what we're doing. Wait. Chill. hold.
I've really experienced that, in that like a lot of people don't believe in it. They don't believe in marketing, or they think it's a waste of money or waste of time. But as soon as you can show results, you can just throw that off and people start to trust it.
Yeah, you have to get the results in. And I think that's another kind of the curse of the B2B is that can take you 6 months, right? Yeah. That can take you, I mean, I think in inbound, we average maybe about 3 months, but we have had customers that have taken 18 months to close because they're big and, you know, there's a lot of moving parts. So it's kind of hard to be like, you know, 2 years down the line, go, I told you I was right. You know, that's I think one of the hardest parts I think about marketing is we had a sign at Plan Day that said like in God we trust, all others must bring data. Not that we're particularly religious, it's just a saying, but it was, you know, when you go trust me, people are like, how? How can I trust you? And so that's where I think these experiments are really good, because you can get results, maybe not necessarily lead generation, but you can get results in a relatively short amount of time, where you can go, look, we tried this and this, and we see a lot more clicks on this. So is this justification, you know, is this enough to let us go with this? And then if that fails, you know, find best practice, reach out to your network. There have been times where I've had to say to people, okay, well, I've spoken to other marketers and this is what they're doing, so that's why we're going to do this. And, you know, you kind of have to, it's a frustrating part of marketing is you spend a lot of time making your case internally rather than executing. And that was something I learned actually, you know, when I just did my ads, I would put my headphones on and just make ads. And that was kind of awesome. Now that I'm a director, it's a lot of meetings and here's what we're doing and here's why. Right. And here's why we're not going to do that. And we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that because we're doing this. And you can't really change direction as often as people would like for you to do that. And you have to be confident enough to say why.
I think I feel lucky, like where I am, that we have, I think there is confidence in it. And there's mm-hmm. They were very patient to wait for like the sort of inbound engine to start working. I think I see that we've gone way over time. Well, a few minutes over time. It has been such an interesting conversation and I've learned loads. And I think anyone listening can like get a lot of value out of this. So thank you.
Of course. Yeah, I'm happy. I love sharing this stuff and nerding out about it. So that's why I do a podcast in my free time. Like yourself. Exactly. Yeah. But it can be very overwhelming. I fully appreciate it can be really overwhelming because there's so much you can do. And marketing is such a wide range of skills and responsibilities. It's from running social media to generating leads to everything in between. And when you're smaller, how do you do it? There's not enough hours in the day. So you kind of want to put your effort where you're going to have the most return. And I completely understand it can be super overwhelming.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And then there's those long-term ones, like, because you want to put your effort in where you know it's working, but then there's those sometimes that you'd have to wait for ages for it to work. So you don't want to.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. It's been really nice talking to you. And obviously congrats and good luck with the baby.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm really excited. Any day now, she's supposed to arrive on Tuesday.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you found this content valuable, please hit subscribe and head over to thefuck.com. That's thefxck.com. And subscribe to my weekly newsletter to get new and intriguing marketing strategies in your inbox each week. Also, please leave a review wherever you are and help me share the word. Or email me on ben@thefuck.com if you have any ideas for improvements I can make. Love you guys.